ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
One of the great mistakes a lot of the political and media class are making at the moment is just presuming that the orthodoxies of politics still apply, and they really don't anymore, and they especially don't apply to One Nation.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is defending itself in US court against claims that it designed deliberately addictive products aimed at children. So what's at stake in this bellwether case, and what happens if Meta loses? And financial intelligence agency OzTrack has made hundreds of referrals in connection with an investigation that's uncovered what they say is coordinated mortgage fraud. So how big a problem is it, and what happens next? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC business reporter Steph Chalmers.
Steph, thank you for joining me. We're over here in Australia, but a lot of the world's attention is on a courtroom in California. It's wrapped for the first day, and this is this kind of blockbuster case against Meta. This is one of the world's most important companies. Billions of individuals use its products. This is across Facebook, across Instagram, across WhatsApp. And this follows on a couple of other cases that we've already seen this year. This keeps being referred to as potentially the big tobacco moment, where a very important company in a very important industry is potentially held accountable for what critics say are deliberately addictive products that are causing great harm. What did you make of the fact that this court session has happened? 29 states out of the 50 in the United States, both Republican and Democrat states have joined this action. The fact that this action has been brought against Meta and what it potentially could mean for that company in particular, but also the industry more broadly.
As you say, with this, it really is the world is watching, because there's people all over most countries on these platforms, not only Meta-owned platforms, but of course, things like Snapchat and TikTok now. And we know those other companies will, of course, be watching very closely themselves, because this is really the first kind of action of this scale and magnitude that we've seen. So they will, of course, be wanting to know how this goes. And as you say, it's really the scale of this compared to what we've seen so far, which are some individual actions that have been brought, and there have been findings against some of the tech giants in those cases. But this really goes to that level of potentially a business model at risk if we see this case succeed against Meta.
Yeah, and there seems to be a little bit of confusion or contradiction about exactly what the penalties being sought are. There has been a suggestion from Meta that it could be the entire value of the company could be the penalty that they're looking at. We're talking more than $1 trillion plus in US terms. Now, the one of the attorney generals from one of the states suggested, no, we're not looking at that much money, but it could potentially be a couple of years of profits. When you're a company the size of Meta, that's a huge amount of money. But I think what's more important is if the judge finds against, well, the jury and the judge find against Meta in this instance, whether or not they will want to actually put restrictions or put in conditions on the way that Meta designs its products. So the crux of this case is whether or not that the company has designed their products in a way that they knew would be addictive, would do harm to young people, or that maybe they didn't design it on purpose to be like that, but they should have known that these products were causing harm and should have done more to ensure that they weren't. It is a difficult question, because obviously if you're a business and you're in the business of advertising, what you're trying to do, in part at least, is keep people on your platforms as long as possible, right? So if you look back at old legacy media, if you're a television network, you're trying to keep people watching. You're trying to make your products so engaging that people don't switch the channel and that they watch the commercials so you can sell that. And when it comes to kind of social media, the Instagram, Facebook model, what you're trying to do is keep people utilizing it, whether or not that's kind of clicking through reels and then having ads in between it, or just spending time on that platform so that you can sell ads to those people. And that's what you're trying to do. Now, Meta's argument has been that they have put strategies in place in order to make sure that children weren't using their products, first of all, that there are age restrictions, but also that maybe earlier on they had a metric which is about just how much time was being spent, but they moved away from that model. And they also seem to have a major problem with the argument that social media addiction is a real thing. They seem to be pushing back wholly on that argument. Do you think that's going to hold weight with the people who get to decide in this case?
I mean, with a jury, I'm sure you'd struggle to say that social media isn't addictive and that social media addiction isn't a real thing. And even based on some of the cases we've seen already, there was one in the US in March which found that Meta and YouTube harmed a young user with their design features that were found to be addictive. So we've already seen some of the evidence that is likely to be brought up in this case is about, you know, internal discussions about these types of models, and the jury in that specific case obviously decided that yes, it was deliberately addictive and was responsible for her mental distress. This is a now 20-year-old who is struggling with anxiety and depression. So I think,
and I think what was so damning in that case, and which is likely to play out in this case, is the kind of internal correspondence. We've got a whistleblower who already took the stand in this case, a Meta whistleblower, someone who used to work at the organization, saying that they weren't taking seriously enough the risks to the users of this platform. And the Meta lawyer has already warned that you're probably going to see correspondence that people don't, that think is a bit cringe or kind of awful when people are talking about whether or not people are addicted to these platforms. But I think that is potentially what's going to be most damning, that they have access to correspondence, internal discussions within this company about whether or not their products are doing harm.
And of course, that's a lot of the selling point of these companies in terms of their huge success in the advertising space. It's not only, you know, that people are going to see your ads, it's the amount of insight they can give due to the sheer amount of time people spend on the platforms, the way they engage, the algorithms can learn about you and target you in such specific ways. You know, as we talk about, it's probably that the addiction is part of the business model. It's where you draw the line in terms of it being harmful rather than just being a really successful business strategy. And we've seen this, of course, as you alluded to, big tobacco and the gambling industry. We know in particular with gambling, it's come to light in years past that the features of gaming apps and of pokie machines, of course, designed to hook you in. And it's some of those same elements that we often hear researchers warning about being used in social media apps, kind of tapping into that reward center in your brain and keeping you looking for the next hit. So it'll be interesting to see where this leads. Like, is this just simply a cost of doing business for these companies now that the industry has reached this level of maturity? Because the gambling industry hasn't disappeared. We now have warnings and things like that. Is it a case that you get a pop-up warning?
The gambling industry is stronger than ever, right? And has actually moved into totally new aspects of the economy, and people can gamble on things that they were not previously able to gamble on. And that's why I do find the analogy of this being the big tobacco moment kind of interesting, because tobacco isn't over. You know, like, yes, there were a series of legal cases against them, and I think it's now broadly accepted that tobacco is addictive, and there have been restrictions in different places when it comes to advertising or who you can sell to or the way you can sell the products. But tobacco is still a massively successful industry around the world. Here in Australia, obviously, we're seeing the rise of illicit tobacco, and there's a debate about whether or not the excise has gone too high. But putting that to aside, these businesses aren't finished. They didn't go kaput just because people became aware of the risks. But obviously, these tech companies are concerned about restrictions that can be placed around them. What I find also interesting here is how the politics of this might play out. Now, Australia's obviously led the way when it comes to restrictions, when it comes to age, young people accessing social media. And we've seen moves around the world kind of following Australia's stead. But Donald Trump's administration has been very angry about any overseas countries or any other country trying to restrict particularly American-owned tech companies from the way that they operate. But this is internal. These are both Democrat and Republican-controlled states taking this action. So in some ways, it's probably good for the Australian government for the battle to be fought over there and for other countries so that this is doesn't become an issue of international relations and instead can be treated almost as a domestic political issue in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think we led the way when it came to smoking advertising as well, and those warning labels on cigarette packets. So this may, in hindsight, kind of be historically similar, you'd have to say. Who knows what ends up happening overseas. But I think it's interesting as well if you think about how tobacco and gambling companies are now treated on the stock market. At the moment, we have these tech companies and social media companies as really seen as technology players at the forefront of things like artificial intelligence and that sort of thing. Widespread money from retail investors through ETFs, super funds is flowing into this sector. Will we look back in 20 years and perhaps it's more of an ESG concern to be invested in these type of companies? And
putting Meta into the same category as like arms dealers.
I don't think this is, you know, just speculating an industry ending point. This is part of our society now. But I guess it's how we treat these companies in terms of their right to just function in a free market, or are we acknowledging that this is a health concern and actually needs to be regulated to the point of things like tobacco?
Yeah, and I think what is interesting when it comes to social media is I think a lot of my peers have moved away completely or very much limited or minimized their use of social media, but it does serve a purpose. Someone who's just been on an overseas trip, it is the easiest way to stay in contact with people. The algorithm is actually very good once you turn up in a certain place of recognizing who's closest to you in that space. People you might have forgotten live in that country are suddenly at the top of your feed. And that's actually very helpful to, you know, trigger that memory, that connection, and then you can contact them and you might, and it makes it much easier to obviously stay in contact with people. So there is obviously a utility, and that's the original reason why people were drawn to these type of platforms. And I think it did allow people to maybe have a broader group of friendships that they were able to maintain. But it obviously, I think a lot of people also, after spending hours kind of doom scrolling on these platforms, think, what a waste of my time. And I do worry about young people who have only known a world where this existed and what that potentially does to the rewiring of their brain. But there is also a libertarian argument, which is that people, not children, but people have a right to do things to themselves that might not be good for themselves. And the government needs to be careful about trying to overregulate people's lives. So I think this will be an interesting issue to be teased out.
Yeah, I got a reminder the other day of that I joined Facebook 19 years ago.
Gosh, terrifying.
Which is extremely terrifying.
Yeah.
And I was in high school at that point. So, and, you know, now having young kids, it is scary to think about, I had my whole childhood without being exposed to this. What does it mean for your brain? And anecdotally, I've heard of Silicon Valley tech billionaires keeping their kids totally tech-free, sending them to schools where there's no technology allowed. And there's also that element that you might describe as conspiratorial, but is this now the moment where the industry starts to sell us the solutions to our problems? And we've seen that with things like those devices that you can buy that you tap your phone on and it then blocks you for a certain amount of time, really taking off. And where are their ads reaching us? Through social media. So you're scrolling through social media and then feeling bad about yourself for doing so, even though it's designed to keep you hooked for as long as possible. And then you're buying a company that, who knows how that's funded, to pay for the solution. I think it will be interesting. I don't think to any extent these are going to disappear from our lives. They're so ingrained in so many parts of how society functions. I think it is just whether at a global scale, because if this changes in the US, and we've already seen those countries following Australia's social media ban potentially, does this become a kind of globally recognised health risk?
Yes, and there is still the live question, Steph, of whether or not Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and founder of Meta, will take the stand. Let's see. Another huge story which broke today, and shout out to the Australian Financial Review who has really led the coverage on this issue. So AUSTRAC has confirmed this Operation Claw, great code name, where they say they have uncovered coordinated mortgage fraud. In particular, they say regarding property in Sydney, and they have now taken the step of referring people to other regulatory bodies, including the police, but also the tax office. So at the heart of this issue is about, it seems in part at least, that it's about overseas money, money sourced, the AFR says, in part from China, but also the Asia Pacific region, and about dubious claims about where this money is coming from, what income people have in order to get these loans. There have obviously been concerns for a long time about people using cash that is being laundered or attempted to be laundered through the property market. This, AUSTRAC says, is not necessarily about their anti-money laundering function, but they are concerned about this kind of widespread fraud. And they say this goes across the board with Australia's lenders. And there are major concerns about the current processes that are in place, and they're calling on lenders to take it seriously in order to try to uncover more mortgage fraud and obviously to stop it from occurring in the future. How important do you think this particular operation, Operation Claw, is?
Yeah, I mean, the name's fantastic, so there's that. But it seems to run really wide, as you say. They've flagged that it's at 10 major banks, so well beyond just kind of the major home lenders and filtering out into some of those second-tier lenders and potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. So we're speaking to the AUSTRAC CEO later, so we'll be able to find out a little bit more of those details. But AUSTRAC has kind of framed this as a wake-up call for the industry, because this isn't actually a new thing. We've been talking for years about so-called liar loans. There was a well-known survey run by the investment bank UBS trying to find out how many people lied on their applications. In 2021, UBS did a survey of around 900 people, and they found 41% had submitted loan applications that were not completely factually accurate. And it was some of the same things that AUSTRAC is now calling out 5 years later, things like fraudulent pay slips, doctoring living costs, doctoring bank statements to remove things to make it look like you don't have kids, or things like that to, you know, change your profile as a loan applicant. And yeah, it's really concerning if the bank is allowing these to go through. And one of the things that was highlighted in the liar loan cases previously was that these are particularly rampant through mortgage brokers rather than directly through the bank themselves. So that obviously introduces another third party that is between the borrower and the bank. Yeah. And perhaps, I don't know what the internal processes look like, but perhaps there's a level of sort of trust put on the broker. So I think that'll obviously ring alarm bells for the banks, which we have already seen in recent years, some of them selling off or distancing themselves from mortgage broking networks and bringing more of that back in-house.
And so the reason we are concerned about people applying for loans fraudulently using fake documents is, I guess, multifaceted. One, of course, it matters less when the property market is going up, because it means that the properties are worth more than maybe the loan. And if someone defaults because they've lied about their income levels and they don't have the assets that they claim they did, then that doesn't become an issue as long as they can sell the property off for more than it was purchased for, more than the value of the loan. This obviously does become a bigger risk for the lenders if, as we have currently occurring, the property market is turning down. And then if for some reason the borrower went into distress or couldn't afford to pay that loan, or just decided that they actually are going to cut their losses and run, then the bank is liable potentially for, does not have an asset that's worth as much as the loan, the money that they lent out. That's the issue. And this is why it's interesting trying to figure out exactly why it is that people are using these have applied for these loans fraudulently, and hopefully we do get more information about this. Is it just that they're trying to hide where they're getting their money from for whatever reason, that if they're sourcing it from overseas, that they're sourcing it in a nefarious way, it's illegal income, they're trying to avoid paying tax in a certain jurisdiction, or they're trying to avoid paying tax here in Australia? And that's why these referrals are quite interesting. And then you have that secondary issue, which is part of the reason why on the 1st of July, all these new occupations were suddenly brought into the anti-money laundering system, which was about making sure people weren't using property to launder money through. And I think they can be connected, but they're also kind of separate issues. But it is interesting seeing them all kind of come together at the same time.
Yeah, I think the Financial Review said there was about 200 referrals to these external agencies, which, you think those cases are more towards the money laundering, as you say, or potentially trying to tax evade or hide sources of income, and it's the real estate agents and lawyers and property conveyancers now come under that sort of know your customer requirement.
Yeah.
But as you say, this other broader issue is in terms of responsible lending, and it is incumbent on the banks to make sure the people they are lending to can afford the loans with a buffer. So if you're inflating your income, that then erodes that buffer potentially and just questions the bank's whole ability to really know if you can afford it. And that's something that's less an AUSTRAC issue and more probably an APRA issue, the prudential regulator that looks over the banks. So I think that's interesting. Will we hear from other regulators on this, from that responsible lending requirement? Because that was something that you'd have to say the industry sort of already have supposed to had a reckoning with when we had the Banking Royal Commission back in 2018, I think it was, in terms of the consequences for people's lives when they were lent more money than they could afford to pay. In some cases, we heard at the Royal Commission, people didn't know they were making fraudulent applications. Mm. It was actually brokers making them on their behalf in order to reap commissions and things like that. So again, this really isn't new. So it is kind of frightening that it's still happening, and especially as we're starting to get AI increasingly used in loan application assessments, which we do know is happening. When we've heard about it, we've gone to the banks and they have said, no, humans are still involved in that end application process. But you'd would have thought that improving technology, things like AI, might be better at picking up fraud than humans looking at a payslip. Like maybe the technology can actually see what has been doctored on a visual level that a human might not be able to pick up. So I think that would be a worry to regulators as well, that this is still around even as technology has presumably improved quite a lot since we last had a big reckoning.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I do think that this is coming at a sensitive time for the market. And as I said, it a lot of this stuff doesn't matter as much when the market's going up. But I think part of the reason the regulators will be getting more and more concerned is that if the property market continues to fall, and you know there are different forecasts about exactly what will happen, but if it does fall by a significant level and people have accessed these loans through fraudulent means and suddenly can't afford it, or they're not the people that the banks thought they were, for example, if identity has somehow been also faked and that makes it very difficult for them to kind of claw, as per the name, the money back, I think that's going to get very difficult. So again, I think this is one we're just going to have to watch how this plays out over the coming weeks. That is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We will be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send in a question, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Steph.
Bye.